Hi, I'm Xavier McFarlane, and welcome to the Catholic City Podcast from the Mary Foundation. Today's episode features Keith Nestor, a former Protestant pastor and youth pastor with more than 20 years' experience in full-time ministry. In 2017, Keith converted to Catholicism. He has since authored two books, The Convert's Guide to Roman Catholicism, Your First Year in the Church, along with Unpacking the Mysteries of the Rosary. He also hosts a daily live stream of the Rosary at 5 p.m. Central, which has occurred without fail every day since 2020, and is now called the Rosary Crew. He also shares lessons on his YouTube channel and podcast. We discuss how I ended up helping to edit his latest book along with Bud McFarlane, the beginnings of the Rosary Crew, why he wrote another book after thinking, never again, the power of the Rosary, Mary, and finally, lessons that Catholics can learn from a former Protestant pastor. But first, if you want to learn more about Catholicism or are looking for materials to evangelize family, friends, and fellow parishioners, please visit the Mary Foundation at CatholicCity.com to order our Catholic scapulars, books, booklets, medals, and best-selling novels by Bud McFarlane. Sign up for Bud's Catholic City Message, where he's been sharing profound insights, sage advice, and crazy stories for over 25 years. We are also the world's largest distributor of the purple scapular, given by Mary to the approved French mystic Marie-Julie Jehenny in the late 1800s. You can learn more at our website, CatholicCity.com. Keith, thanks for coming in. How are you?
It is awesome to be here, Xavier. How are you?
I'm doing really well. We're also here with Anthony, as usual. He's our operations manager and the director of outreach for CatholicYoungAdultGroups.org.
Hello.
So many of you may know that we met Keith originally because we helped edit your book.
Actually, I met Anthony and Bud.
When I met you.
Yes. Yeah, you kind of saved us because we were working hard on this book and you kind of looked over your shoulder and were like, what are you maniacs doing over there? I need to fix that. And then you came over and like it was like the magic happened.
Was that Star Barn, right?
No, I'm talking about when we were here working on,
on
this book. But it was a Star Barn when you were there with Bud. Mm-hmm. That's when Bud pulled me aside and he was like, hey, Keith.
He didn't pull you aside. He attacked you.
He attacked. Yeah. I didn't know who Bud was from anybody. He's like, hey, Keith, let's go have drinks.
Yep.
And I'm like, all right. It was like 10 o'clock at night. Last night. They remember that? Mm-hmm. And then he said to me, he's like, I want to help you with your next book. And I'm like, who are you? I had no idea who he was. Because I'm a convert. I don't know anything about like what was going on in the Catholic publishing world in the 90s, you know? Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, okay, we'll go out and hang out. So I talked to these guys, and he gave me a copy of a couple of his books, and he said he wanted to help me with my next book. And I'm like, I don't even know what my next book's even going to be. And he's like, well, when you're ready, we should do something. So I went home, and a few months went by, and I went over to one of my friends' houses who are very strong Catholics. And when I walked in the front door, I about tripped over this box of Pierced by the Sword.
Oh,
a case of Bud's books. And I said, what's that?
Fascinating.
And my friend, she said, oh, that's my favorite book. It changed my life. I give away a case of that book every year to people in my life because that, and I'm like, I know that guy. And you might've, you know, I could have told him I knew Elvis for all, mm-hmm. you know, they were like, what, you know, Bud McFarlane Jr. I'm like, yeah. So I actually got him on the phone and he talked to him for like an hour on the phone. So then I went home. I thought, I should probably look at this book. And I read it and I loved it. I was blown away. I thought it was amazing. So I called him and I said, hey, okay, I think I'm ready to work on this book if your offer still stands. And he says, absolutely. So I wrote the manuscript and then he invited me to come out here. And that's when we kind of went through the book line by line, which was what an amazing experience that was for me because I'm not really an experienced writer like that. And so between Bud and Xavi, guys who know a lot about writing and the techniques involved, and like you guys just had a really amazing way of taking what I had come up with and making it better, even like from my perspective. You know, sometimes when you have something you've created and then someone else gets their hands on it, it sort of becomes less yours.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt like what you guys were able to do was make it more consistent with what I had in my brain than what I was able to do, it was the power of God all over that project for this book. And the book we're talking about is called Unpacking the Mysteries of the Rosary, which has been a game changer for lots of people since that time.
Me included.
Oh, you read it? Awesome.
No, I use it as source material for a couple breakout sessions that I've led.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome.
It's profound. It's good.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's something about the difference between being good at ideas, and I know your background, you used to preach a lot. And mm-hmm. You still do in just a different way.
Yeah.
So, like, your ideas were good and they were there. It's just the translation of putting them into this format that's called a book, where it's written words in paragraphs, on pages, in chapters, and like fitting it all together. And I think one of the things that made it work was that the ideas were all there and they were all very good. It's just that weird craft of the book part.
Yeah. It's a really different animal altogether. And I'll tell you, like, this was my second book. And after we finished with this book, I struggled because I really wanted to go back and redo the first one. Mm-hmm. You know, I was like, oh man, imagine if I could get these guys on that to basically do like a redo of that book, but I can't touch that book. I mean, that book, The Convert's Guide, that was my first book, The Convert's Guide to Roman Catholicism, Your First Year in the Church, that book continues to outsell the second one by far. It's not even mm-hmm. close. So it's like, I love the Rosary book. That's the thing I'm most proud of that I've ever made. And it's having a different kind of impact though, because the Rosary is something that is like everyone thinks they know everything about the Rosary,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, people barely begin to scratch the surface of it. It's kind of like if you were someone who plays chess or something like that, it's easy to learn, but it's hard to master. And I feel like the Rosary is kind of like that. It's easy. Everyone sort of has this familiarity with it, and they go, oh yeah, the Rosary. But when you start asking them questions about it, like what the mysteries mean to them or their own personal experience, it's amazing how many people haven't really dug that far into it.
Mm-hmm.
So when you see that begin to happen, it's like all these lights start going on in people's spiritual lives. And that's a lot of fun to see.
Mm-hmm. It kind of makes me think of, like, we know what it is to exercise, roughly.
Yeah.
Like, you know, maybe run or like lift some weights, but then you go to somebody who really knows what they're doing, and they're like, oh, you just got to like change this muscle movement a little bit and maybe a pain goes away that you never thought you could get rid of. It's kind of like that. I see at least a parallel.
Yeah.
When, just because we're in the business of evangelization here, quote unquote, at the Mary Foundation, you converted, was the Rosary part of that, or was the Rosary one of the roadblocks to that?
It was kind of a roadblock, I would say. And a part of it, and that sounds like a weird answer, but let me tell you like how it happened for me was when I started to get interested in Catholicism, it wasn't because of the Rosary. I would say at that point in time, it was a roadblock. Like I was like, oh, that seems kind of weird. But I got exposed to a lot of I call it the Mary stuff, you know, when I was taken on a pilgrimage over to Medjugorje, when I was very much a Protestant youth pastor. I was being kind of drug along on this trip. But while I was over there, obviously I got exposed to a lot of Marian devotion. I got exposed to seeing the community of people who worship Jesus through the Blessed Mother and how that worked. And then it was almost like I saw like a different dimension of color in the spectrum. I'm like, oh wow, this is a whole different aspect of Christianity and of faith that I haven't seen before. So then it became sort of this feature of Catholicism. Was all that, but I still felt very much on the outside of it. I didn't feel like that was for me because I wasn't Catholic and I couldn't quite relate to it. And then years later, when I was on my journey back into the church, the Blessed Mother really grabbed a hold of me in some pretty interesting ways, but the Rosary wasn't part of that initially. That didn't come along for me until I'd already made the decision that I wanted to become Catholic. Mm-hmm. And then I decided, okay, I'm going to really try to understand the Rosary a little bit better. And I started praying it by myself. I wasn't comfortable with praying it in groups. Really, the way people prayed it was really hard for me. And I'm sure everybody has the stories of what it's like to be in groups of people that pray the Rosary either really, really too fast or really too slow.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, this will be something that's just good for me. And then it wasn't until 2020. So I came into the church in 2017. And then I kind of started praying the Rosary by myself. But then in 2020, when the pandemic hit, I jumped on a live stream on YouTube and someone in that stream asked if I would lead the Rosary on my YouTube channel. And I said, well, I've never done that before. And I was a little bit freaked out, but it was the pandemic and, you know, somebody asked me to do it. And I thought, well, okay, I don't have anything else to do now. Nobody does. So we hopped on the next day. I said, okay, we'll meet back here on my live stream at noon the next day, which was March 18th, 2020. And we did our first live stream rosary. I didn't know what I was doing. I made a ton of mistakes. I messed up a lot of stuff and everybody was patient with me. People showed up on the live stream to pray. And when we got done, they said, well, can we do this tomorrow? And I thought, okay. So we did it tomorrow and then we kept going. And long story short, we just had our 4-year anniversary of the Rosary crew. We call it now the Rosary. We gave it a name eventually, but, and it's been amazing. So we've led the Rosary on that channel over 4 years every day. And I have seen the Lord just not only transform my own life, but our family, I feel like, is different. Our marriage, I feel like, is different. And I've seen so many people through that community come to faith and go deeper into faith through praying the rosary.
How big is the audience these days?
Oh, man. It's in the thousands daily. So we'll have we stream onto my YouTube channel. I have two YouTube channels. I ended up creating a separate channel for the Rosary Crew. So I have one called Rosary Crew with Keith Nestor. And we stream to that channel and then to, I think, 5 Facebook channels. I stream to multiple platforms and then Instagram too. And we'll probably have 6,000-7,000 people every day, not necessarily live. We'll have a big group of that pray with us live, but then there are people, we call them Team Replay. They go in on the replay later because it's all over the world. There's 82 countries in the Rosary Crew. So people from all over the world are praying at different times. So I'll through my computer program that I use to stream, I can see all the comments as they come in real time. And I'll leave that on at night. And then in the morning I'll come back and I can look through and see when people were coming in there. And there will be people, there's probably people at this time right now putting in prayer intentions for yesterday's rosary because it's a different time for them. So it's growing like crazy, which has just been incredible.
So did that inspire the book? Did that inform the book?
It completely inspired the book. Because when I started doing the rosary, you know, I didn't know what the mysteries were. I thought they were just sort of like you say the mystery and then you just pray. But
like acknowledge
the mystery. I think you're just like acknowledge the first joyful mystery, you know, the Annunciation, and then you just pray. But what does the decade have to do with the mystery? You know, I didn't really understand any of that. And so really the Rosary Crew kind of was my own learning in real time in front of people. So I started thinking about those mysteries and then I would just share a brief meditation about each of those mysteries before we jump in. And I didn't plan to do that. I just kind of started doing it because it'd be like, oh, you know what just occurred to me? You know, the first mystery in the Joyful Mysteries is the Annunciation. And this little book I was using from the Rosary Center had these spiritual fruits in the mysteries. And I didn't know that there were different versions of that. So I thought that was like the universal fruit. Like for the one that we use, the first Joyful Mystery, the Annunciation, the spiritual fruit is humility. Other people would say, oh, well, I used it for this or that. But I'm like, well, this is just what we're going to do. And so I would talk about like, it would hit me. I'd be like, hey, have you guys ever thought about what it must have been like for Gabriel to be the one chosen to go give this news to Mary? I mean, because think about that. The angels knew the prophecies too. They understood this. And for all these ages past, they had been waiting too. And then Gabriel gets the call. Okay, it's time. And so I just began to share that. And some people got really mad about it. They were like, we don't come here to hear you talk about stuff. We just come here to pray. But other people were like, that was amazing. That really helped me to understand. So I just kind of said, okay, I'm going to share, you know, relatively brief little meditations some of the time, not all the time. And that's what turned into the book was I came to actually I was here in Bay Village. I was asked to give a talk on the mysteries of the rosary. So I put together this talk. And when I delivered the talk, I'm like, this is going to be a really, really crappy talk because it's going to be like 2 hours if I really do it right. So, but this would be a great book because I wrote out meditations for every one of those mysteries and it was like super long because there's so much there. And I'm like, okay, I just had to plow through that talk to give it in, you know, an hour or whatever. But in the back of my mind, I'm like, that needs to be a book.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where that grew out of.
So you created your own spiritual fruits for the book?
No. I just used the fruits that we had in that, it's called Rosary. It's okay. Like a little pamphlet from the Rosary Center. I think it's a bunch of Dominicans that put mm-hmm. that out.
Okay.
That's what I used. But I would just add my own thoughts to like my own applications. Because, you know, I was a Protestant pastor for 20 years. So for me, everything was about practical application mm-hmm. of like, to me, like the number one question I always ask when I'm thinking about these things is, what does this mean to you? And what does it look like for you
mm-hmm.
to meditate on, let's say, the Sorrowful Mysteries, which we're going to do later tonight, okay? We're going to talk about what it means that we meditate on Christ's passion in the garden, right? His agony in the garden and how he says to Peter, James, and John, could you guys not keep watch with me 1 hour? And then I'll ask people sometimes, I'll say, what does that mean for you to, through the rosary, keep watch with Jesus?
You know, speaking of that,
yeah.
The one that stumped me the most, I would say, is your reflection on the third Sorrowful Mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain that to me again? I think it's something, from what I recall, Christ's kingdom is
yeah.
not of this earth.
Yes.
So basically,
The third Sorrowful Mystery is the crowning with thorns.
Yep.
The spiritual fruit is the reign of Christ in our hearts.
Mm-hmm.
And when I think about that, I'm always thinking about the context of that particular historical event, okay? Jesus was standing before Pilate, who was questioning him about his kingdom, okay? And he was saying, are you a king? Are you a king? And Jesus is saying, I'm a king, but my kingdom is not of this world. And what he means by that really is, I'm not the kind of king that you expect. I'm not the kind of king like these other kings out there. The kings of the world, they exercise dominance and control and coercion, and they exist to exploit their subjects, right? The purpose of the king is to rule over his subjects, and their purpose is to basically provide for him. Our king is different. Jesus lays down his life. He's the kind of king that allows himself to be tortured and to be killed. And he says, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. So he's that kind of king. So it isn't a statement when Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this world. That doesn't mean that he is not the king of this world. He's the king of all kings. He is the king. We pray, thy kingdom come. So we absolutely believe that Jesus' kingdom is of this world from the standpoint of his ultimate authority and power. But when it says not of this world, like meaning of the same substance of the kingdoms of this world. So he's a different kind of king, and it's a different kind of kingdom. But it absolutely exists in this temporal realm and in the spiritual realm. But it's so radically different from the kind of kings that Pilate was used to. So if Jesus were to say, yeah, I'm a king, Pilate he wouldn't have understood that because, well, then what are you doing here with me?
Right.
Where's your army?
Or we're seeing it as a threat.
Yeah. Or what are you, you know, we have no king but Caesar. The Jews knew that. That's why they were playing that up to him, because they knew that if they could convince Pilate that Jesus was a threat to his kingdom, then Pilate would have to execute him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Jesus even says, like, if I were a king like that, like, wouldn't my attendants be here to free me?
Exactly. And he's always highlighting that difference. So, and I know we're in a weird time in our climate in our culture right now, where that whole phrase Christ is king, people don't know what to do with that. And some people shy away from it. Some people blast it out there. You know, I think we should blast it out there, but I think we should understand what it means and recognize that his kingdom, yes, it has this sense of ultimate reality, but where I like to go with it is where I don't hear a lot of other people going with it, to be honest with you, which is, okay, the spiritual fruit is the reign of Christ in your heart. So you can say Christ is king, Christ is king. What does that mean for Anthony? What is that? Where are the parts of your heart where you're still king? Where are the parts of your heart that you haven't surrendered to the King of Kings? That's what I like to do. I like to dig deep into like each person's heart and say, man, okay, I'm really good at knowing theology. I'm really good at the devotional life. But I'm really crappy at holding a grudge. or I'm really bad about greed, or whatever it might be. We've all got something in our hearts, that these little parts of our hearts that we've protected from the kingdom of Christ, because whether they comfort us or whether they make us feel secure, or we just haven't quite figured out how to let go of all control, they're those parts of our own little kingdom that we protect. And when I think about that third sorrowful mystery, I'm thinking, okay, I can't hold anything back from him. Because when I imagine him standing there, you know, and of course I imagine Pilate says, behold the man, you know, ecce homo, you know, behold the man, Jesus. And he's standing there with that crown of thorns, and he's covered in blood, and he's got the purple robe that was meant to mock him. To me, that's huge. I think about that every time I go to Mass. You know, behold the Lamb of God. I think about that moment. And I think that is not just a like a liturgical element. It's actually a command. Behold the man. You look at him. And then you have to decide, what are you going to do with him? What are you going to do? That's what that third mystery is about for me.
Yeah, that one struck me.
Yeah.
That one was good.
It's heavy, man.
There's something about that word behold that is different than see. It's even different than like look at and investigate. Like it would be weird to tell someone, hey, look at your wife, or like see your wife. Like there's something nice about that. Maybe there's not something weird about that. But if someone said, look at your friend, and you're just like, okay. And like you look at him, that's kind of it. Like you did what he said to do. But if someone says, behold your friend or behold your spouse, you're going to look at it in the way, maybe like in a deeper way than by analogy, someone looks at a piece of art where they're like, okay, what's the meaning here? The author or the painter or the sculptor was trying to communicate perhaps a message, or is just beautiful. And you let that sort of sink into yourself. So when it's like, behold the man, it's like, behold the God who has become man, laid down his life as a sacrifice for us. It's like, sit back. Yes, look at it with your eyes, but like, look at it with your whole being, and then receive and let sink into you whatever is being offered.
Yeah, it's like, and I think we talk about this in my first book, but I use the analogy of drinking cheap wine versus drinking really expensive fine wine. You know, when you say, oh, I'm going to drink this wine, if it's like a really expensive fine wine, you don't drink that the same way you drink a Diet Coke, you know. You behold that wine, like you're smelling it. You're allowing every part of you to interact with it, and vice versa. And when you behold Jesus, you're not just treating him like you treat everybody else. It's like comprehend at every level of your intellect and soul who he is and what he means.
It sounds like you acknowledge the truth of the nature of the thing that you're beholding. Yeah. So you give it its just due.
Exactly.
If you behold it.
Yeah.
Right? You can behold the Diet Coke, definitely, but you're not going to treat it the same way as you would that fine wine.
Exactly.
Right.
What were some of the, I don't know, maybe it's like go read the book, because it's just every time you talk about one of these things, it's we could go on for multiple hours about even just this beholding concept.
It's cool. Yeah.
So just in the interest of, we do eventually have to go pray the rosary after this.
Yeah, we do. That's right. We got people coming. Yeah.
So you start, it's like you start the rosary crew, you start praying with people, and then just kind of organically, it's like, hey, I was thinking about this. And then people are like, can you think more and then tell us what you think? And you're like, okay. And then that turns into a talk, which then turns into a book.
Yeah.
And now that the book is real and out there, what is kind of the reaction and effect you see?
Well, I've had people really give me a lot of good feedback on the book. It's the thing that has been the biggest affirmation to me has been people who have started getting into the rosary as a result of reading the book. I know there's, you know, so many encyclicals, there's so many books about the rosary. There's no shortage of material on the rosary. And there's no shortage of material on like how to pray the rosary in terms of the mechanics of it. But I don't know that there's a lot of stuff that's how to allow the rosary into your heart when you pray. Like how do you really enter in to the mysteries and all of that? So like to me, when people have talked about, oh, I got it after doing this, that's been awesome for me. And with the Rosary Crew, it's just story after story that I hear from people, a lot of them who aren't even Catholic, who, and a lot of them become Catholic, who are like, yeah, I started, you know, I found this on YouTube and this has been huge for me. But I'll tell you one quick story that happened about a year and a half ago. I was recording the audio for the audiobook, and I do that out in Colorado at this cabin that we have. And I was driving back from the cabin to where I live in Iowa. And when I go to pray the live stream, usually we do it at 5 o'clock in the afternoon on during the week. And where I happened to be on the road, usually on I-80 is around Lincoln, Nebraska at that time. So I pull over at the first truck stop that I can find. I'm running late. It's like, okay, I've got literally like a minute to like pull over, turn on the live stream. I'm in my car with my dog at a Pilot Flying J truck stop. And the rosary comes up and I'm greeting the people in there, and there's people in the live chat. And I just said, hey, from the Pilot in Gretna, Nebraska or whatever, we're going to pray the Glorious Mysteries. So we start praying, and I'm sitting in my car with my laptop, right? And right when we got to the fifth glorious mystery, the coronation of the Blessed Virgin Mary, this car pulls up next to me. I can see out of the corner of my eye, and I see this flailing around in this car. And I kind of like look over. Now, remember, like I'm on camera live stream, so I can't just be like, hey, hold on, everybody. So, but I kind of do this and I look over, and there's this woman, and she's got her phone and she's got a rosary, and she's going like this. She's waving and she's pointing at her phone, and then she's pointing at me, and I realize she's praying with us right now. So I just stopped. I said, okay, hold on, everybody. This just happened to me. I rolled the window down, and she rolled her window down, and she said hi to my dog. She's like, hi, Lucy. And I'm like, you're praying with us? And she's like, yeah. So I said, well, what's your name? And she said, oh, my name's Tracy. And people recognized her from the chat. And she's like, I heard that you said you were at this place. I was driving down the road on the interstate going somewhere, and I whipped around and to come find you. So we pray the rosary together, right? And then I get done, and I start talking to this woman afterwards. And she tells me, and she's about my age, I think, I'm guessing. And she says, you know, I was far from God, and I got diagnosed with cancer. And she's like, I have stage 4 lung cancer, and I have 4 kids, and the rosary crew helped bring me back to the faith. And she's like, now I lead other people in the faith. I talk about the Blessed Mother all the time. And this woman just had so much joy in her heart and in her face. She's like, I'm not going to be able to sleep tonight. This was one of the greatest days of my life, to pray the rosary, you know, with you like this, to run into you out here and do this. And it was so amazing, the power of this community and what this prayer does to unite people. So, you know, we said goodbye. I gave her the rosary that I had been using, and her mom emailed me later that day. It's like, it's so funny because like, well, all these people are connected. Like, mm-hmm. So like her mom emailed, I'm Tracy's mom, blah, blah, blah. And you have no idea how meaningful the rosary crew has been for her. And this prayer has just changed her life. Well, she passed away last fall. And that was hard, you know, like everyone in the crew like knew her from that experience. But what I remember about her was a woman that, despite being in the valley of the shadow of death, she had no fear. She had joy, and she had absolute faith in whatever was going to happen. And I asked her about, I'm like, man, you got 4 kids. She says, I have given them over to the Blessed Mother. They're going to be okay. And I had never seen anything like that in my entire career in ministry before, like that type of assurance and faith and just love. I mean, it was so incredible. So that's one, but there's so many other stories of people that we have interacted with, and we've got to hear their stories and learn from. And it's just so incredibly amazing. We met a guy last night who just came into the church over the Easter Vigil, and it started with praying the rosary. And I went to give him a couple of copies of my books, and I gave him the conference guide. Then I went to give him the rosary. He's like, oh, I already have that one. He's like, that's what got me here, you know? And he just joined the church just recently. And I've just never seen any tangible thing have that much effect on people's souls than praying the rosary. It's just been, it's been incredible.
I want to hear your thoughts on, because I think this is a really cool sort of element of the rosary. People often liken it to a weapon.
Mm, yeah.
So I know Dominicans, I think, wear it on their left hip in the place of a sword. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, I remember hearing that. That was something that got me interested in it because right around the time I was converting to the church, my mom was dying of cancer. And I felt pretty out of control with that. I was very unsure what was going to happen in my life because I knew the Lord was calling me to become Catholic. I think I had already quit my job or had already given him my notice, you know, at my Protestant church. And I didn't really know what life was going to look like, but I knew I needed to become Catholic. And there were a lot of parts of my life that seemed really insecure, but yet I had this peace that I was doing what God wanted me to do. And when I heard about the rosary as a weapon against evil, I think that was the idea that got me to go, okay, I need to do this because I needed some spiritual ammo in my life to get me through some of this stuff. So I've since learned a lot more about the spiritual side of Our Lady and all of that and how that works and Marian apparitions, different things like that, and how the rosary has been used by lots of people for those types of ways. And I've experienced that in my own life. Like, I feel like the rosary has made me more of a whole, it's enhanced my holiness. I mean, I have a long way to go, but like, I feel closer to the Lord than I've ever felt. And I 100% attribute it to praying the rosary every day. And when I have encountered darkness in my own life, the first thing I do is pray a rosary or I pray a Hail Mary. And it's almost like I've just experienced it. I can't explain why. But I'm convinced of it.
I know for me, at least the very act of pulling it out of my pocket and beholding it and understanding, or at least thinking about it as a weapon, a spiritual weapon against the diabolical, it inspires confidence to me when I experience darkness in my life. So just the very thing itself, you know, the beads, just inspire that for me.
I think it's a gift to us to have something tangible like that because, you know, so much of your faith, whether we want to admit it or not, is filtered through our own emotional status at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember a lot of times feeling like, you know, I used to be a worship leader, so I'd be up front leading these worship songs, but I might not have even felt very close to the Lord. You know, it's just kind of like, well, what are you going to do? You know, you have to just work through that. And a lot of what we do in our faith is rooted in these physical touch points that the Lord gives to us. And, you know, things like the Eucharist, where he's truly present with us. He's there whether we realize it or not. He's not waiting for us to believe in order to be there. He's already there. And I think the rosary is one of those things where it's like this is a something that when you grab it, you have that muscle memory of praying the beads, and it's just something that you can grab a hold of and use that to center you. People say, well, things like, well, how do you stay focused? You know, with the 10 Hail Mary. Sometimes it's like I need all 10 because I'm off in left field somewhere in my brain. I'm running this live stream. I got people spamming the comments. I've got other people getting mad at each other. I've got, you know, my dog is barking because she wants food, you know, whatever. It's like there's a lot of other things going on. And sometimes I need, in order to get one Hail Mary, I need a decade. That's worth anything. You know what I mean? Like from my heart.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay. So when people say things to me like, well, how do you stay focused? How do you stay on track? How do you not get bored? Like, I don't ever need any help not getting bored because like it's sometimes a fight just to do it. And when you recognize, okay, that's all right. It doesn't have to feel good. It doesn't have to be easy. I think more grace comes to us when we do it anyway, when it's hard. And when we have to power through it, even when we go, man, that was worthless. It might feel worthless to you, but it wasn't worthless to Our Lady because that was when you said, okay, I'm going to do this even though I don't feel it. So it's a weapon against all these spiritual things, but it's also a weapon in your own heart against your own lack of discipline at times. It's a weapon against your own desire to slack off because, you know, you got 10 beads. So, I mean, you're not going to just like pray three of them and move on. I mean, who's going to do that, right? You're going to like, okay, this is helping me in a lot of ways. So it's a weapon on many different levels.
Mm-hmm. And I can just attest, and it's highly suspect coincidence that this was last night. So I just got married in the fall, and the first night away from my wife was 2 days ago. So the night before last. And it was not a great night. Like I hadn't experienced that yet. And you know, it was a drop off. It's definitely not the same as being like sleeping next to your spouse. And last night, so the second night, I remembered that like, oh, I normally, before I got married, I would sleep holding a rosary, but it became a little unmanageable with two people in the same bed. Like I would get caught on stuff, whereas somehow I'd manage to sleep without like tangling it around my neck. So I was like, I remember that. And I slept holding a rosary and I was fine. And it's like, it's interesting to me. Like that's a small example of sort of the potency of it, but it's interesting that it was last night.
Wow. I think it's crazy that we're here now doing this, you know, and that happened to you last night. There's just so many things I think God has, you know, and that's that has orchestrated. And I feel like that's another element. And I think my wife could attest to this too. Like when we started doing the rosary together and praying the rosary and the rosary crew, we started seeing all sorts of weird kind of like answer to prayer or things happen or whatever. And I feel like my life has been just one of those things after another. I mean, the reason why we're out here on the road, we were shoveling snow one night in the winter in 2020. And we had just, you know, we had a photography studio. That was what my wife had been doing that forever. And I went into that after I quit the church and we decided that we wanted to be done with that. And so we decided we were going to sell it. And we had been talking about how cool it is that we have this internet community, but we were like, everyone's so isolated. You know, we're in Iowa, people are all over the world. We get together on the computer, but you know, we love community and it felt like we didn't have it. And we thought about, wouldn't it be cool to travel around and then meet with people from the Rosary Crew in different ways, but how do you do that? Well, we were, I don't know what we were doing like on YouTube one day, but we came across like all these van lifers, you know, you see them on YouTube, these kids that sell all their possessions and buy a van and drive around, you know? And when I was growing up, that was what, you know, that was like the joke was you're going to live in a van down by the river. Well, now it's like the goal. So I remember she said to me, well, what if we sold the building and took some of that money and bought a van and traveled around. And I had, there was a woman from Canada who had said she had a dream that we came to see her and pray the rosary. So we thought about it and we're like, you know what, let's just do it. So in 2021, we bought this motorhome, this little Sprinter van, and we started traveling around. And when I would go to do a speaking event, instead of flying, I would just tell the host, hey, whatever you were going to give me for a plane ticket, I'll buy gas with it and we'll just drive. And we've been, I think this is our 7th or 8th trip now. I think it's number 7, I think, where we just go and we just meet with people in various cities and people show up to pray the rosary. And sometimes there's like 3 or 4, sometimes there's like a couple hundred. Like we never know what we're going to run into. Sometimes it's part of a parish mission. Sometimes we're with friends like you guys, like we're going to go do later. And I've already heard from some people that are driving. Last night we were in Joliet, Illinois, and there were people that drove 3 hours just to come pray the rosary, you know, and they're like, we pray every day with you, so let's go do this. And that has been like the best thing ever, because now it's like we're seeing not only the prayer aspect, but the community aspect of it. And one of my favorite things about being Catholic is that we are all united, even though we're so different in so many ways, we're all united under our faith and the church. And the rosary is this incredible source of unity with people, because I feel like with all of the liturgy wars and all of the different controversial things that people are always talking about and people are Catholics are divided about, I've seen people pretty much united around the rosary. You know, I haven't gone down the rabbit hole of like people fighting about the rosary yet. Now it's probably out there, but I haven't seen it yet. So we have like people that are from all different perspectives and life stages and everything. And they're all drawn together to pray the rosary. And when we're on the road, we get to meet these people in person. And it's like they've truly become family to us. It's absolutely awesome. And that all started because we did that live stream, you know, and it was like, okay, pray the rosary every day. Okay. See what happens. I really believe that if you do that, you offer that up to Our Lady, she will take that and do something amazing in your life with it.
Short thought, only because you mentioned controversy. And I was like, the part of my brain that just goes off the rails was like, well, can I think of any? And I did think of one thing, but you probably have a good answer, which is, quote unquote, should one meditate while praying the rosary on the mysteries or focus on praying them individual, like Hail Marys? Well,
Okay. I thought you were going to talk about the luminous mysteries. We can talk about that in a
minute. Oh, I forgot about that one.
That's another controversy, but let's do that first. Let's do what you said first. I think the answer is yes. I think you can do whatever. Like, and this is the beautiful thing about the rosary. I don't think everyone has to be the way everybody else is. I think there will be times when you really truly meditate on the mystery, and the Hail Marys are just sort of like muscle memory, because in your mind you're really focused on that mystery. And I always tell people, like, put yourself inside that mystery. Imagine you're there. Who are you in that mystery, right? Like, are you the guy on the side? Are you in the temple at the presentation? You know, are you walking with Jesus on the road in the fourth sorrowful mystery as he's carrying the cross through Jerusalem? Or are you the Roman soldier that's like pushing him? Or are you trying to be Simon of Cyrene who's going to help him carry it? Or, you know, like where do you feel like you are in this story right now? There'll be times when you're just, and then Hail Marys is just sort of like, boom. There'll be other times when you are praying those Hail Marys as if they are drops of water and you are dying of thirst. And spiritually, you need every drop that you can get. So it's just, you are like literally in the palm of her hand, just begging for her intercession. I think it's all good. I think it's all good, because it's one of those things that the more you enter into it, it starts to enter into you. And that's not always going to be a one size fits all. That's where I think we get so messed up, is we find something that works, and then we just like, we encase it in concrete and go, that's the only way I can ever think about this. That's the only way I can ever do this. That's the only way this can ever be for me. And then we don't grow with that, you know? But I think that our spiritual lives, it's organic, you know, and we grow, and we need to be able to have devotions that flex with us.
Mm-hmm. I think it's one of those things that intuitively it actually makes perfect sense. It's very obvious that it has to be that way. But once you kind of overthink it, then you can think that there's the quote unquote right answer is a specific concrete thing, like in the different sense of the word. And I thought, like, we often talk about how things are alive. Like, the Bible is alive. The liturgy is alive. The rosary is alive. But then I was like, okay, let's flip it and do the intuitive reverso thing. And I was like, well, a dog is alive and a couch is not. So we don't want the couch to be changing shape on us. We want to be able to sit in it. And like, maybe it has like a lever for the little leg rest. But other than that, like, it stays the same shape. We want that constant dead. Whereas your dog, you're like, you don't want your dog to be the same shape. It's got to run around and sleep and be hungry sometimes and play fetch sometimes and sit on your lap. Like, it's intuitively obvious that this thing is not stuck in its form. And that's the kind of thing that the rosary is. And it's weird that we get caught up in thinking that things like dogs should be things like couches.
Well, so I love the way you put that, because the rosary in one sense doesn't change, but you do. And I think that's the beautiful thing about our faith, is like, the truth of the faith is, I mean, we find security in the fact that doesn't change. Like, I don't have to create and invent that every time I want to pray the rosary. I don't have to be like, all right, how am I going to make this? And that to me was huge, because before I was Catholic, I felt like I was always in this state of trying to reinvent everything and trying to top it and trying to like find some new clever angle on something to make it more interesting. And it was very much subjective to what I could do with it. Whereas in our Catholic devotions, they don't do that. They are what they are. But what I've found is that it's like a surgical instrument. You know, the scalpel is not made out of rubber. It's made out of like hardened steel, but it cuts through you. And if it was made out of, like, let's say, ooh, that's really sharp, it hurts. Oh, let's make it out of cotton balls. Well, then it's not going to do its job. So you need it to be what it is, but you need to be flexible. Think of the analogy of in Jeremiah where, you know, the Lord says, you are the potter, you know, or I'm the potter, you are the clay, right? And that's the image that the Lord gives Jeremiah. And when you think about how that works, okay, the clay has to be moldable. It has to be formable until it's done. Then it's set, right? We are not done yet. The Lord is forming us. We have to be moldable, right? He's not moldable. He is who he is. Truth is not moldable. But the way we interact with it is going to change. That's why I love how Jesus says, let he who has ears to hear, let him hear. That's a call to be moldable. That's a call to say, understand what this is going to do in you if you let it in. But that doesn't mean that you can, you know, that you have to rearrange it and mess with it. So I think that's what I love about the rosary is it's a private devotion, yes. And, you know, there are some things that are sort of optional, like the different prayers at the end people do and some kind of, you know, some of those things, whatever. But at the core of it, those prayers are what they are. Mm-hmm. And you know, which real quick, let's jump into the luminous mystery thing because that I guess that would be a bone of contention for some people because I've had people that have like flipped out at me for praying the luminous mysteries. I love the luminous mysteries. I didn't know when I started praying the rosary that there were some people who didn't like them. I didn't know that because I was new. I was just like, okay, cool. And you know, so when I do have people that will sometimes push back on that, usually they're, you know, new to the rosary crew. If they've just found us, they're like, oh, you guys pray the luminous mysteries. I'm like, well, we do, but you don't have to. You know, they were given to us as an option by St. Pope John Paul II, as an option. And faithful can pray them or not pray them. And I don't judge anybody who doesn't pray them, but I also won't be condemned by anybody who doesn't, you know. So I like to pray them. I think that they're powerful. To me, I mean, especially the second luminous mystery, the wedding at Cana, I mean, just the fruit of that mystery, you know, the intercession of our mother. I mean, that's incredible. That's what the whole rosary is all about. So, but I would say that's probably the one area where sometimes people will still sort of like, depending on what they're used to, you know, where they formed in the faith before the 2000s or when, I think it was 2000, I think when he did that, something like that.
I think it was October 21st, 2000.
Yeah.
Or October 20th. Cause it was the night before my little brother was born.
Oh, wow.
Something like that, or the week of, or the Tuesday, something like that.
Yeah.
But it was October 2000. Mm-hmm. I remember I tried to look into it, and it gets funky because the origin specifically is a little hazy. It's like and I'm remembering something vaguely, so I could be very off. So if you know the right answer, don't hold me accountable too much. That it was given to St. Simon Stock or referenced by Mary when she gave St. Simon Stock the brown scapular, which was like the 1600s. But the phrasing used was like the...
Pray my Psalter.
The Psalter, right. Yeah. The way of saying Hail Mary prayers in groups of 10.
That was the St. Dominic, I believe.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I told you I would screw it up.
So
yeah.
That's the legend around the origin of the rosary. But the luminous mysteries, they, you know, St. Pope John Paul II didn't invent those. And I think Father Calloway talks about it in his book, Champions of the Rosary, where they come from. But he's the one who kind of, they were called like the mysteries of light or something like that. And he brought them together and offered them as like a new option.
Well, that's kind of my point though, is that in the origin of it, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was just like 150 Hail Marys. That's what the Psalter meant.
Yes.
And then,
so that's why people get
weirded by it. To help people along the way, quote unquote, options were added with more specificity, like the Our Fathers, the prayers in the beginning and after, the mysteries themselves weren't necessarily part of that original practice of 150. So it's kind of like, to me, and again, I'm sort of the same. Like, if you do what you're going to do and be holy. So to me, though, it's like 150 seems to be really the only specific argument on any origin level. And after that, it's like, did a Pope say to do this or not? Because we're like, that's our Catholic thing is the Pope, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, again, I'm cool with it as far as like, I mean, it's a private devotion, but that doesn't mean that there's a wrong and a right way to do it. I mean, there's not a wrong or a right way to do it. But it's not as if that the church has dogmatically defined you must do it this exact way. And if you, I mean, if the church somehow came out and dogmatically defined something, then we're going to do that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the Pope said, here's an option if you want to do it. And I think they're cool. So I like them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there's also other ways you can use a rosary too, like Divine Mercy Chaplet.
Yeah.
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 So maybe if you don't want to consider the Luminous Mysteries part of that Psalter, then you pray the Luminous Mysteries separately.
I know people that do that too. Like, yeah. I've heard some people that say, well, I will meditate on the Luminous Mysteries, but I do that separately from praying my rosary. And I'm just like, hey, you do you, man. Yeah. Like, what? That's
compartmentalize.
How you'd yeah. Like. I don't know. But to me, like, I included them in my book. I include them on the Rosary Crew. We do them. I think there's incredible value in each of the Luminous Mysteries. The one that I think that people don't know what to do with is the Transfiguration, like the fourth Luminous Mystery, because the thing that makes that one a little bit challenging is it was a mystery that was intended for three people initially, Peter, James, and John. And the Lord told them, don't tell anybody about this until after the Son of Man has been risen from the dead. Okay? So in some sense, we have what it was all about was showing them a greater level, a greater understanding of a greater revelation of his glory. He didn't become something more glorious. He already was. He just allowed them to see that. But in the resurrection, we see something even greater, you know? So it's sort of like the Transfiguration was like this private moment for Peter, James, and John that he shares with them for the specific reason to give them this assurance and this courage that everything's going to be okay, you know? And that, of course, he's connected to the Law and the Prophets. You know, he's there with Moses and Elijah. But sometimes a lot of people ask me about that. Like, I don't understand that one, you know? But to me, it's all about one thing. And this is just where my brain goes with it. It's all about the danger of taking Jesus for granted. And Peter, James, and John, they were with him for three years every day. And I don't care who you are. You know, if you do the same thing, you could do the most amazing thing for three years every day, and it's going to become routine, right? And I wonder if those guys sort of started to take Jesus for granted. I mean, you kind of think that when they start arguing about stupid stuff and, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think when he showed them that revelation of his glory and the Transfiguration, they were like, whoa, they were blown away. And it's just a general reminder to all of us that we can never make our faith and make Jesus just kind of the backdrop of our life. We've got to be blown away by him every time. And I think to me, that's what I take away from that mystery, because I don't ever want to just sort of be like, yep, there's Jesus up there on the altar, body, blood, soul, and divinity. All right. What am I having for lunch today? You know, or like, I don't want to be like that. I want to be in awe of him every single time. And to me, that's what that mystery is about.
What's the spiritual fruit for the Transfiguration?
Courage.
Courage.
You think about what Peter, James, and John were going to have to do, right, as Jesus is making a beeline for Jerusalem, right? And they have to have courage to be the leaders of the church. They have to have courage to strengthen the guys. And get this. He said, don't tell anybody until after I've been raised from the dead. And we have a hard time with this because we weren't there. But do you notice that even when he appears to them after his resurrection, they still can't quite wrap their minds around what's going on? In John 20, right? He appears to them and it says, and they saw him believe, but some doubted. Okay? How could you be beholding the resurrected Jesus Christ right in front of you in the flesh and still there's a part of you that doubts? You know, and I think that when he revealed himself to them, they were, no, we saw this. You guys, now we can finally tell you what we saw. Moses was there. Elijah was there. He like blew up in this dazzling array of light and his clothes became white like the sun. And you guys, we saw this. And now he told us we had to wait until this moment. Now we can tell you guys. And I think that when we have to interact with those types of things, we have to always remember how dazzling he is and how incredibly blessed we are, and we can't take him for granted. So that's where the courage comes from, because when you know you're going to walk through some difficulty, but you know you're not going to walk through it alone, and you know that who you're with, you know, our dad beats their dad. And it's like, okay, we're with this guy. Nothing bad's going to happen to us.
Mm-hmm. Right. I thought of something I've never thought of before in relation to this too, which is just in trying to parallel it in kind of a normal life way. It's like, there are definitely times where Jesus gives us stuff that we're supposed to hold on to until later with particular people in terms of believing things. Cause the other 12 apostles were there, but there are other people, like they're still preaching and doing the Jesus thing. And then, but they're sitting on this to like, and maybe it's an experience in adoration or like receiving the Eucharist or grace and confession or just something in prayer at night where you're like, wow, yeah, this is God. It's like that dazzling brilliance. And there's someone in your life who you could just be like, right in that moment, be like, you got like buy in already. Like I saw him in his dazzling brilliance, but they kind of, you have to wait for them to get the seed, like see in whatever way, like Jesus in front of them. And then you're like, now that you see it, you're ready to hear about the dazzling brilliance story.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. That's huge.
Mm-hmm.
It's like other people aren't ready to hear that news. Is that what you're getting at?
Sometimes. Or it's like there's a specific time that maybe even will be sort of hinted at in the prayer in the same way Jesus was literally telling them, don't tell anybody until then.
They'll be ready.
And obviously this is like prudence. Like we don't want to just keep everything secret. But yeah.
Oh, yeah. For sure. I've seen that happen where people, you can talk to them about something with the faith and they're not ready for it. But then when the lights go on, they're like, oh, that, you know, that happened to me too. So it's, you know, it's, that's the experience of being, I don't know, touched by grace in some way where it's like, you know, that grace that we need, we can't do that on ourselves. God has to do that to us. So we have to receive that grace. And when God touches us with that grace, it's just like the lights go on and you can't unsee it anymore.
That reminds me of something we were talking about before, how Mary is polarizing.
Mm-hmm.
And for would-be converts, she's either roadblock or she's the key to accepting Christ. Enlighten us why that's the case.
Well, I think a lot of Protestants or non-Catholics, they don't understand what Catholics are doing with Mary. You know, they think we're worshiping her. They think that we have like idols of Mary and, you know, and so there's a lot of like difficulty just understanding it. People aren't, they don't know what the church teaches about the Blessed Mother. They don't understand. So for some people, that's the obstacle. It's like, well, if you believe that I'm saved from Mary, then I'm not even going to give the Catholic Church the time of day because I know that's not right. Right. But then when you explain it, no, that's not what the Catholic Church teaches. And then you begin to walk through in the scripture where these things come from. And then they begin to kind of open their eyes. A lot of times I think it has to do with the scriptures because, you know, for a lot of Protestants, the number one question that they ask is, well, where's that in the Bible? Where's that in the Bible? And when you can start to open the scriptures and show some of these Catholic truths around the Blessed Mother in the Bible and help people to understand, I've seen like that's when the lights start going on. Oh, wow. I didn't realize that, you know, full of grace, what that really meant. And why did Gabriel say that? I didn't understand the connection between Genesis 3:15, where he says the woman... I will put enmity between the woman and the serpent. He's talking, you know, the Lord's talking to the serpent, and her seed will crush your heel, right? How when Jesus calls Mary woman in Cana, right? We always thought that he was insulting her. Woman, what does that have to do with me? When she says they have no more wine, when he calls her woman, like I look at that now and I go, he's connecting that, right? And then John, the same one who wrote about that, he writes in Revelation 12, and I saw a woman clothed. He sees the vision of her in heaven, And he's also the one to whom the Lord said, "Woman, behold your son, son, behold your mother." So he heard Jesus say to Mary, "Call her woman." So there's like all these things that connect. And when you start to show people all these ways that Mary has been foretold about and all the ways that prophecy's fulfilled and her role, when you see that in scripture, it's like, oh, the light starts going on. But until that, people are just like so put off by it. And then when you finally can help people to begin to just open, crack their heart a little bit to the idea of asking for her intercession, that's when I've seen like the lights really go on with people, when they've been willing to do that. And I have some people in my life that I know that were very far from the Catholic faith, and they did that and things have radically changed.
Are any of those stories you can share, or at least like?
I will share one with you that I'll just kind of keep it anonymous, but I have a friend who is a Protestant pastor, very, very reformed pastor. Okay. When I've known this guy forever, and when I became Catholic, he was just like, "Have you lost your mind?" I mean, we were going to go to blows over it, which I was never really excited about that. And I don't know, maybe about a year and a half ago, we started talking and he started like commenting on my videos. And I thought, oh man, this is going to be bad, because he's really smart. And I thought he's going to start tearing me apart on YouTube. And he wasn't doing that. He was asking questions. And then we would get together and he would start talking about things. And I started to get the sense he was beginning to be intrigued by Catholicism a little bit. And I challenged him one day when we were together to pray the rosary. And I brought a rosary for him. And I had actually, I gave him one of your guys' miraculous medals from the Mary Foundation. And he told me that he likes to go for walks every day. Okay. And he reached into his pocket and he happened to have that medal in his pocket and he grabbed it and he's like, "I don't know what this even is, but I'm just going to hold it and I'm going to ask for her intercession." And I mean, long story short, he's like ready to like become Catholic now. And he prays a rosary now. And it's been amazing. But it all started with that little seed of cracking the door a little bit to the Blessed Mother. And it's, you know, I know others, I mean, we could go on and on and on, but I know other people who have had the same similar experience, who have just been willing to just give it a chance. And she has just said, "Okay, let's do this." And it's been really, really cool.
Yeah, there's power in the rosary.
Yeah. But also the miraculous medal, I figured you guys would, I should just tell you that because it was one of yours.
Yeah.
Well, that's why they're on every rosary.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the beating heart of
the
weapon.
It was awesome.
Yeah.
In another direction, because we're getting on time here a little bit.
Yeah.
Before we got to get moving. One of the things we do is the CatholicYoungAdultGroups.org, where we try to, it's the young adult ministry world. And I think the Catholic Church, at least if you know, is famous for being pretty bad in this category.
Yeah.
Coming from Protestant youth, and I would just kind of ponder that there's probably young adult thrown in there as a youth pastor.
Yeah.
And maybe even defining what those terms are for us. What do you see that's good and then not good? And like advice, tips,
in Catholicism?
Yeah.
Well, okay. So, you know, young adult to me is, you know, graduated high school, sort of, you know, in the, you know, I think it keeps changing. I think it gets older now. Like a young adult is like 29, where, you know, maybe a young adult used to be like 23. So I think it's more about, have you figured out what you're doing with your life yet? Are you married? Are you in your career? Or are you still trying to figure it out? And then of course, youth, I would say, you know, high school, college age or whatever. What we do right in the Catholic Church with that is we don't create another parallel church experience just for youth that exists sometimes in the Protestant world. Okay. And I'll explain that in a minute. We integrate everyone into the same experience, the liturgy, the mass. So like, for example, when I was a youth pastor, we would have, you know, like there'd be adult church going on, and then we'd also have like youth church. So like we had youth church, like instead of like having a youth group, we'd have like youth church. So then a lot of people did that because they didn't want to make the kids sit in boring adult church with the, you know, with the old fuddy-duddies singing the hymns and, you know, listening to the super, like they wanted to do fun, cool stuff. So we would like make youth church, you know, and I think that's a bad idea personally, because I think that that caters too much to that sense of, well, the church and the experience of worshiping Jesus is really about me and what I prefer and what I like, because when they get out in the real world, they're not going to have that. And if church has always been put to them in something that's fun and exciting and all about their, you know, being, I don't know, like stimulated in some way, then the moment that they don't have that, they're going to check out of church completely. Okay. So it's good that we don't do that in the Catholic Church. But I think what is where we, and I think this is true, whether young adults, old adults, whatever, the thing that I've noticed that we don't do a good job with in the Catholic Church is we don't do enough with small groups. Like in the Protestant evangelical world, small groups are almost more important than Sunday morning worship time, you know? So a lot of churches, they invest a lot of resources into discipleship, small groups, fellowship, so that people have relationships that they're going through their Christian life with other people. And it's almost like a mandatory thing in a lot of evangelical type churches. If you're going to be part of this church, the first thing we're going to try to do, you know, like if you guys came to my church when I was a pastor, like day one, the first question I'm going to ask you guys is, hey, I'd love to get you plugged into a small group with some guys that are your age, so that, because I know that you're going to get bored listening to me, but if you are connected with a group of young adults that are about your age or whatever, then you're going to stick around longer. But we don't do that. That's sort of like, I've seen that in some aspects in Catholic churches, but it's almost like that happens because somebody really, really, really wanted to make it happen. Not because that's built into the DNA and the fabric of the church.
Can you just briefly, couple seconds, explain what the day-to-day life or the structure of a small group is? Just so I,
yeah, so,
so
imagine,
I'm hearing you right.
Imagine a weekly gathering. Let's just say you're going to get together on Tuesday nights, you know, at whatever. You're going to go over to somebody's house, or you're going to meet in a bar or restaurant or whatever, and you're going to hang out. You're going to eat some food together, and then you're going to go through some sort of spiritual exercise together. Like you're going to be studying a book together, or you're going to be working through some material. But listen, this is the key, okay? Catholics do that, but they are doing it for a different reason. Catholics do that because they're trying to like learn something, okay, which is important. But evangelicals do it so that they can fellowship. That's a different reason, okay? That's a different purpose. They're both good purposes, but they're not set up for the same reason. So like, for example, a lot of Catholic churches will have these book studies. So you'll go on like, oh, we're going to do a book study through whatever book that Bishop Barron wrote or something. He's got a book and we're going to all get together. So we go to the church basement sit on the metal folding chairs under the fluorescent lights, and it's cold, and we're going to sit there and we're going to watch a really boring video. No offense, Bishop Barron. We're going to watch a video for 15 minutes, and then someone's going to get up and just lecture us through the material. And then as soon as it's done, everyone disappears. And there's nothing to connect the people together for the sake of connecting them. It's all about consuming this material. We consumed this material together, and we call that a small group. That is completely different than what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is the material is almost inconsequential, okay? It's a means to an end. The end is the relationships. That's the fellowship aspect, the personal relationships that are going to help you stick and that are going to be a resource to you far beyond whatever 8-week study you're going through.
Have you been following us around or something?
No, but I probably know what you're doing, because I think that Catholics are hungry for that, okay? But they haven't been brought up with that. So it's sort of like they're trying to crack the code on something that seems so difficult, but like it's really not.
Well, you know what's interesting, Keith, is we have another podcast series where we'll bring a young adult leader on, mm-hmm. and just you know, Xavier and I are young adult group leaders, so we share our experiences and they share theirs with us. And then it helps out the other young adult leaders who might be listening, right? I think the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 podcasts, that structure, that small group's idea has come up. And in almost every case, the young adult leader that we were sort of interviewing, having a discussion with, has done it successfully.
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, well, maybe that's something we should do for ours. And we actually implemented that now, and it's going to be starting this month for the same exact reasons as you're describing. We've talked about this at length over many meetings, just trying to plan it out and put people in the right small groups. But it's all for the reasons you're talking about, like the exact verbatim reasons, and that's weird. It's providential.
It's human nature. I mean, we're communal people, and we were created for relationships. And we've made the mistake in the church, and it isn't just the Catholics, but I mean, I've seen this in a lot of different places. We've made the mistake of reducing what it means to be in fellowship to meaning just like physically being with other people while you're doing something completely separate.
Yeah, I actually, and I like to avoid that word like the plague.
Which word? Fellowship?
Yeah, because
nobody knows what it means.
Whenever I see it on something, I know it's like, and no offense to anybody who puts the blood, sweat, and tears into working for the church. Like, we're just, it's tough. But if I see it on something, I'm just going to suspect it's like, okay, we have something going on where people will be in the same place.
Pizza.
And there'll be pizza or food or something. And maybe it's a talk. Maybe it's like a theology on tap, or maybe it's a, you know, parish mission. And they just slap the word fellowship on there.
Yeah.
And a lot of experiences of when you go to something like that is church basement, fluorescent lights, hard to meet people. Once it's over, it's done.
Yeah.
And so it's like, I don't want to use the word that is exactly the word for the thing we want to have.
Well, I think that makes a lot of sense. Now, this is going to date me, but it's still probably relevant to a certain degree. But where I learned this was like 20 years ago, maybe more. Rick Warren from Saddleback Church in California wrote The Purpose-Driven Church. Okay. And that was what it was all about. And the guy that was my hero in youth ministry was his youth pastor, a guy named Doug Fields. And he wrote a book called The Purpose-Driven Youth Ministry. And he talked about how these focuses in your church get mixed up because nobody knows what they mean. And he said one of the purposes is discipleship, which he defines as learning more about your faith. Okay. But there's a separate purpose called fellowship. And we confuse those two things. We think because we have a Sunday school class where we're all sitting in the same room learning something, we've automatically had fellowship. And he makes the exact same point you're making, Xavier, about we put that on everything, fellowship, fellowship, fellowship. But when you've really truly experienced fellowship, you go, that's not that. Fellowship is about relationship, and it's about deep spiritual relationship and a real sense of bonding and camaraderie in your faith. And we Catholics have that. We have so many things that bring us together, but we don't do a good job in churches of connecting people to those things. If they find them or they create them themselves, it's sort of by accident it happens. But, and I'm sure there are some parishes out there in the world that have figured this out, but it seems by and large like that is more of an evangelical phenomenon than it is a Catholic phenomenon. And I think that's one of the things that as converts, we've looked at that and said, we need to be doing that. Now, this, of course, is ultimately a Catholic thing. I mean, if you look at what Catholics historically have created, I mean, religious people, that is fellowship. They live in community. They've created these orders. That's what that is, right? If they've created these different types of orders, but like for a lay person who's just trying to like go to church and be a good Catholic, there's far too many people that associate that with checking the boxes of the sacraments, okay, and just doing the things that make me a good Catholic. But I can do that completely on my own. I don't need anybody else to do that. Well, technically, you might be able to execute those tasks or whatever. But your life is going to be far richer when you engage in this community aspect. That's why I love the Rosary Crew so much, because We are seeing this community being formed. We are having fellowship, even if it's a virtual thing through the computer. We're, you know, this live stream, like we are having this fellowship out here. You guys will see it tonight. There are people driving from distances to come tonight to this thing. Okay. You guys are going to see them and they're going to be like, we can't believe that we get to come together and do this. And it's so amazing. And we'll hang out afterwards. We'll tell everybody, hey, we're going to go eat dinner here, and they'll come and they'll want to be around. I mean, I've already been invited to sleep at different people's houses that heard I was coming here, you know, because people want that fellowship. They want that experience. And Catholicism is ready made for it. It's just that at the parish level, we haven't figured out how to do that because we just expect people to do it on their own. But as our culture has devolved, we have been sucked into technology and different vices that have isolated us to where it's no longer the default. I mean, 100 years ago, you probably didn't have to make people do stuff together. They had to do things together. If you look at cultures that aren't so technologically advanced, you know, like I'm thinking about like people raising barns in the Amish community. You know, you don't have like Amish families that are, they just come home from work, they shut their carriage in their garage door and they don't come out. You know, everyone eats together. Everyone is together. Like that's the way humanity is made to be. But our society has gone so the opposite direction that we have to be super intentional about what does fellowship mean and creating that. And then what's hard is convincing people that they need it. Because people are, they're so like their guard is up, their walls are up. They don't want like people getting too close to me. But once they kind of experience it, then it's like, oh, wow, I need this.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad to hear what you guys are doing. Keep it up, man. I think there's a lot of power in that.
Well, it gives me hope because one of the things you said was it's like it's not really about the substantial, quote unquote, like learning, or it's like whether it's a Bible study that you do or like maybe praying the rosary together. Like that part of it isn't so consequential as the fact of that your people getting together to be. One of the phrases I heard about this that I really liked, in the rhythms of Catholic life together.
That's perfect. Just do Catholic life together.
It gives me hope that you just can kind of just wing it and throw it together and then it'll sort of self-correct because it's the people involved. It's not, did we, you know, curriculum the course correctly or something?
Yeah.
But we didn't wing it either.
I mean, like, yeah, rough.
Well, you learn what really matters. Mm-hmm. And when we get done with this, you need to talk to her because that was her job in church. Was she was a, for those of you listening, I'm pointing to my wife. She's here too. That was her job for years. She was a small group coordinator in churches and she would recruit leaders and form groups and launch these big campaigns all across groups. She would take churches that went from no small groups to like 20 small groups. And so she knows how to do that. She knows what's important as far as the most important aspect of identifying and training leaders, because that's the key. Too many times we think a good small group leader is someone who's like a really good teacher, okay? Or someone who likes to talk. That doesn't mean they're a good small group leader. So you have to know who the good leaders are for that and how to equip them and talking to them about how to run a small group. Because there's a lot of mistakes you can make that can kill your group just like that. And there are simple things that you wouldn't even think that's bad. But like, for example, I'll give you one quick one. One example is with your small group, what time does it stop? Okay. We used to do these groups at our house all the time. We'd invite people over and we would always tell everybody, you can arrive at 6 and you're leaving by 8:30. You will be done by 8:30. And it's not because we're telling people we want them to be out of our house, but we're telling them how long their commitment is. Because what can happen is if you don't do that, people will feel like, well, okay, I want to go over there, but man, I had to be there till 11 o'clock at night. You know, it's like, when can I leave? You know, it's like, it's hard when you show people here's what your time commitment's going to be. You set that up ahead of time. That gives people permission to leave. It's like, so for example, if someone knows that they're, okay, I really want to go to my small group next week, but I got a lot to do. I'm busy. I'm behind with some stuff I got to do at home. But hey, I know I'll be home by 8:45 because I know but if the group's constantly running late, you know, then they're just gonna be like, I can't go tonight. I don't have 4 hours to give to this, you know? So something as small as telling people, okay, we're done at 8:30. That's something that people wouldn't think, because they go, oh, I want to be hospitable. I don't want to tell people that they have to leave. But you absolutely need to do that, because people need to know what their commitment's going to be.
It's counterintuitively hospitable.
It really is. And there's a lot of things like that go into that.
Mm-hmm. Great. Does she do contract work?
She does. We'll have her people call your people, but.
I love that expression, because I am my people and she is her.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Well, we pretty much have to wrap up to start prepping for the rosary coming up.
Yeah. I can't wait. It's going to be exciting.
Any final thoughts, just off the wall stuff? Kind of, this is open to the floor too, Anthony. Or even Estelle, like, you can come in and say something if you want, no pressure at all. Just last parting words for the listener.
Well, I'm just excited to be here. I want to thank you guys for what you're doing at the Mary Foundation, and for I think it's so cool how the Lord has sort of like connected our ministries and our lives through the writing of this book, which is so cool. And I know that God's got other things in store as well. So thank you guys for what you're doing. And, you know, I just encourage everybody to continue to pray the rosary and meditate on those mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Keith.
All right. Lastly, just how do people find you?
So my ministry is called Down to Earth. So I have a website, downtoearthministry.org. It's downtoearthministry.org. You can also go to rosarycrew.org. That'll take you there also. I'm pretty active on YouTube. I do a weekly Bible study called Unpacking the Mass, where I do like a little Bible study on the upcoming week's readings. So on YouTube, you can just go to Keith Nestor, or you can go to Rosary Crew with Keith Nestor. And if you just Google all that stuff, you'll find it. So
can they find your books on there too?
Yeah, they're on my website. They're also on Amazon.
Fantastic. All right. Thank you, Keith. We really appreciate coming in to talk to us and the awesome work you're doing for the church.
Thanks, you guys. Keith.
All right. That's all, folks. We hope you were inspired by this podcast, and we encourage you to share it on social media and warmly invite you to distribute our Catholic scapulars, medals, books, and booklets to your family, friends, parish, and social groups. Visit us online at catholiccity.com for more information. The real work of the Mary Foundation is accomplished by people just like you. There are three ways to help. First, please pray for everyone who hears, reads, or wears our materials. Second, share them with everyone you know, family, friends, fellow parishioners, and the people you work with. Only you can reach them. Finally, please help us financially. It seems impossible, but we don't do traditional fundraising here at the Mary Foundation. We rely on your generosity and God's providence. By the way, if you, your parish, or your Catholic group would like to distribute our materials by the dozens, hundreds, or even thousands, all we ask for is help covering our materials costs. So please visit us online for suggested donations. For our Canadian friends and those outside the United States, only online requests are accepted, so please refer to the special shipping rates listed on our website. Thanks for listening, and we're looking forward to working with you. May God bless you always. And now, here's a short preview of our Rosary and Divine Mercy Chaplet, the most popular rosary recording in the history of the world.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven.
Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen.
For an increase in the virtues of faith, hope, and charity. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen.
Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.
All rights are reserved, and any duplication without permission is prohibited.